Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, before we get started with the show, I wanted to mention something about Congressman John Lewis. The life of Congressman John Lewis is going to be honored in many ways this week. His body's going to lie in state in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda starting today, and NPR will cover the initial ceremony live, so we wanted you to know that. You can hear that coverage starting at noon on WPR's News and Music Network, and also at WPR.org. Turning to our topic today, there's a new discovery made by a team of scientists at the UW-Madison, and it could serve as a replacement for petroleum-based products like gas or engine lubricant. Today we're learning all about fatty acids on the show, what exactly they are, and how they could play a role in bioenergy production. On the line with us, returning guest, Tim Donahue. He's the director of the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and interim director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Great to see you, Larry, even though I can't see you.
That's good to hear your voice. Oh, man. We also have a first-time guest, Rachel Lemke. She has been working alongside Tim for more than a decade, first as a graduate student and now as a senior research specialist and lab manager, learning how furan, fatty acid, is produced in certain kinds of bacteria. Rachel, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you so much.
You can join in as you listen to these two experts talk. Easy to do. Well, you can talk about bioenergy production with us today at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Tim, fatty acids are some of those things that make up, the good fats, I guess, in foods. You got the leafy greens or fish. But they're more than that, I guess. Can you at first maybe just explain what are fatty acids?
So, thanks, Larry. Fatty acids are basically are hydrocarbons. They're lipid. They're grease. So they have a variety of uses. As lubricants, as fuels, as fuel additives. We're excited about all of those things as we've gotten closer to publishing and speaking about this work. It's obvious that these furan fatty acids are also potentially useful as antioxidants, food additives, antioxidants and fuel, to help with antimicrobial resistance. So they have a whole plethora of uses.
What makes a long chain fatty acid? What makes something a long chain fatty acid?
That's a technology definition in the field, but I would say anything longer than 10 or 12 carbons long.
Okay.
And Rachel, the molecules that Rachel discovered are on the order of 18 and 19 carbons long.
Oh, so Rachel, you're looking at a special category then of these fatty acids, furan fatty acids. Is that the proper way to pronounce that?
Mostly, it's furan fatty acids.
Furan, okay.
And they're really interesting molecules that bacteria produce in response to oxygen stress. They're, again, 18 carbons long, and then there's a furan ring with an oxygen in it, which is what makes it particularly valuable as a biofuel.
So why does oxygen make it valuable?
So it's kind of like the spark that can light the fire to make other hydrocarbons in a fuel mixture fire and explode.
Oh, okay, I got you. How did you get interested in this type of work?
Well, way back, a long time ago, we were trying to discover how the bacteria Rhodobacter soroides was able to grow photosynthetically while in a microaerobic environment. So Rhodobacter soroides grows in freshwater ponds. And so they can photosynthesize just like plants do. That's how they can get energy. And so we were studying, why and how certain pathways worked to help protect the bacteria from oxygen stress. And in the process of that, we were characterizing some genes that we didn't know what they did. And so we were making genomic knockouts and looking to see what they looked like. We looked to see what the proteins were similar to, and the proteins were similar to enzymes that altered fatty acids. And so for a long time, we didn't know what it was. And with the help of some good chemists, we were able to finally figure out and nail down what it was. Then we started doing bioenergy work, and we realized that this molecule would be good in biofuels.
So what makes it good, just in lay terms, what makes it good or what would make it good in a biofuel?
So long-chain fatty acids, as Tim said, act kind of as a grease. So they can be a good lubricant for engines, good oil. And putting it into a mixture with other fuel molecules, like I said, it acts kind of like a spark to ignite the fuel with that oxygen atom there. So you kind of accomplish two things at once. You're lubricating your engine and you're sparking more reactions for the biofuel to produce more energy.
That's pretty cool. Well, I'm trying to figure out in order to produce this on some sort of a massive scale, you need a lot of bacteria.
Yes, that's correct. So if you think about what you'd like to do, we would need quite a bit of this. So Rochelle has done a really good job of saying that this is going to help us burn fuel more efficiently and produce less pollutants in the air. We currently add spark enhances or oxygenates, they're called, to automotive fuel now at about 10% of the fuel mix. So to make this at scale would require a lot of it. One of the beauties of the bacteria that Rochelle has discovered these molecules in is the fact that they are amenable to large-scale fermentation by industry. So if we could increase the production of these even more, we could, in principle, make enough of this to keep the engine people and the various other groups that want to make it to feed their appetite for these molecules. So that's really where we're going.
Oh man, that's really pretty cool stuff. I'm trying to think of how you would make such a large amount of it. Go ahead.
So what you would need is a microbe that can grow on materials that are cheap and easy to produce, and many of the organisms that already make many of the bacteria that Rochelle has discovered or predicted to make this are kind of voracious eaters of cheap renewable food. So they would not have to grow on expensive molecules like glucose or other sugars that are being used for other purposes. They will eat the renewable waste. They would need to grow to high density, and that's one of the beauties, again, of the organisms that we've discovered this in. And we would need to be able to grow them in large quantities. And again, many of the organisms that we've seen this pathway in or begun to overexpress it are already used by industry to make chemicals for a variety of purposes. So we're not there yet. but we think the potential is there in the next couple of years to get there.
It's really interesting. Talking today with Rochelle Lemke, Senior Research Specialist at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, and also Tim Donahue, who directs the center, and also Interim Director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute, visiting with them about this new research, and we can talk about other aspects of production as well with them as we move along. You can join in at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And we have Kel in Sugar Camp on with a question, so let's go there. Hi, Kel. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to know what's going to keep this from being bought up by the petroleum companies. Over the last 40 years, there have been a lot of energy discoveries, and they get bought up and shelved so that they can keep their dominance. What's going to keep this from happening with your discovery?
So we have patents that have already been issued on this by the university through our technology transfer partner, the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, or WARF, and they are actively pursuing the licensing of this. When WARF's been doing technology transfer for the university very successfully now for over 90 years, when they do licensing, I'm not a licensing expert, I'm a microbiologist, but when they do licensing, they might license it to your company to be used as a nutraceutical or a food additive. They might license it to somebody else to be used as a fuel additive. And if we're right, refineries would want to make these types of molecules because they would be very valuable. And the profits they would make from making these molecules actually benefit their economics by letting them make fuels more cost effectively.
Ah, interesting. Kel, thank you so much for that call and question. I appreciate it. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Talking about energy on the program today with our two guests, Rochelle Lemke and Tim Donahue. I'm Larry Mueller. Natalie Guyette, our producer today. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. And you are listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about the new discovery made by a team of scientists at UW-Madison that could serve as a replacement for some petroleum-based products and has other uses as well. It's great to visit with our two guests, Rochelle Lemke, a senior research specialist, and Tim Donahue, directs the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, interim director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Questions or comments for them, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Rochelle, let me go back to you. You've been working on this for a while. Where are you in terms of thinking about I know you're getting a patent, the UW is getting a patent on this, but where are we in terms of being able to let it out into the world?
Kind of like Tim said, we know that if we want to have this molecule, we need to be able to grow the bacteria on a large scale. The other thing to think about is how we liberate the fatty acid from its backbone, which can take some chemicals to do. So in terms of where we're going next is trying to figure out if we can engineer the bacteria to produce more of this, and if we can engineer them to just produce the fatty acid away from the glycerol backbone. So that's kind of the direction we're headed now. But right now it could technically be done. It's just harder to liberate the fatty acid from the membrane of the bacteria. So we're doing some more research into ways we can do that cost effectively.
Yeah, cool. Evan in Viroqua will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Evan. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking the call and for the program. So it sounds like you're working on something that might replace ethanol. I don't know if I heard you say that or not, but that's what I'm guessing, and I'm curious if that's the case. Like, what does that mean for soy farmers, et cetera?
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So it is going to allow us to burn fuel more efficiently, but remember, it is a hydrocarbon in and of itself. So it might not need to replace ethanol. It might be part of the 90% of the automotive fuel that's hydrocarbons, in addition to the 10% of the ethanol. It might also be something that allows jet engines and shipping diesel and naval diesel to burn their fuel more efficiently and therefore cleaner, with less pollutants in the air. So I don't necessarily see it as competing with ethanol. I see it as potentially adding a new hydrocarbon to the fuel mix and allowing us to have cleaner combustion and therefore less environmental damage. And I also see it as a molecule that potentially has all of these other uses in as antioxidants, as anti-inflammatories that are medical, as well as nutraceutical. So it has a large number of potential uses.
Yeah, very interesting. Evan, thank you. Let's take another call. Richard in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Richard.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I have two questions. One is, are the fuels that this is hopefully going to be making, are they more diesel-based or more gasoline-based? And the second question is, will any of this eventually be available for the home user to more or less make it in their backyard kind of thing?
Huh.
So I could see it being a cross-engine fuel additive, depending on what the combustion studies tell us. So let me be frank, we're very excited about this. But as I sit in my office here on campus and look across the street to the College of Engineering, there's an engine center who is very excited about us giving them enough material to actually see how it burns in the different types of engines that you just mentioned. And as Rochelle said, we need to make more in order to ship it across the street to do that. So we are very interested in beginning to overproduce this and provide it to our collaborators to see how well it burns in these different engine configurations, hopefully with no changes to the engines.
That would be a kind of a key thing. Something that already works in existing engines and also fuel lines and that sort of thing, and all, you know, where gas or whatever diesel is stored. If there's no change to the infrastructure, that would be a big plus.
That's correct, and that's the other beauty of having this be a hydrocarbon, because it's going to dissolve in the fuels that are already there, and it'll hopefully help them burn easier. In terms of making it in my garage, I would be really concerned about putting anything I make in my garage in my car. So maybe that's just me. Maybe there's a lot of other people in the country that would feel more comfortable putting it in their tractors or in their cars or in their ATVs. But I like to buy things that go by industrial standards before I put them in my car.
Rochelle, how do you kind of, what's the process, sort of, the, without getting into all of the details, I mean, how do you actually make this stuff?
So I produced a lot of this, or a lot being relative to milligram quantities, to get the structure of it from NMR. And when I did that, I grew 4 liters worth of cells to get like 70 milligrams. So it just involves growing a lot of bacteria and harvesting them, and then treating them with chemicals to isolate the fatty acids. And if we want to get just the furan fatty acid away from all the other fatty acids that the bacteria produce, then we have to isolate it on an LCMS, which is liquid chromatography. And so that's all kind of a bit of a process.
I guess it is. Well, Tim had mentioned earlier that you can grow it on less expensive ways than some of the other bacteria. What do you feed the bacteria to make it grow?
So we have a relative to Rhodobacter soroides, where I originally found the system, that also produces the furan fatty acids, and it's called Rhodopseudomonas palustris. Rhodopseudomonas palustris can eat very weird things, and it's a very versatile bacteria. And so we've been using that also because we can have it grow on a variety of different compounds. And active work has been done in our lab to see if we can get it to grow on things it can sort of grow on, but not well. And so we try to evolve it. And so that's been a good way to do with that.
Give me one of those weird things that you grow it on.
One is called gamma-valerolactone, which is organic.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's actually something that the center has used to make hydrolysate from corn stover. And Tim will know a little bit more about that.
Yeah, Tim, you want to add in?
Well, I'll just add in and say that both of the organisms, the two organisms that we've done the most work on to overproduce this compound, these compounds have the ability to grow on the leftover waste from making a biofuel like ethanol or isobutanol. So again, these are organisms that to a layperson you can think of as growing on the stuff that you would normally throw out or put in an anaerobic digester or burn to generate heat for the refinery. And our vision is not to take the materials in these residues and burn them, but to take them and take those renewable residues and upgrade them into valuable chemicals, providing fuels and chemicals for a variety of uses, but also providing economic value greater than heat or electricity, which is pretty cheap right now, given the glut we have of natural gas, to a refinery to increase their bottom line by making a variety of products instead of only making a fuel.
Yeah, that is really cool. Richard, again, thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Ron in Windsor next. Hi, Ron.
Thanks. Since the mid-70s, I've been a renewable energy advocate and sometimes use it. And early this century, I narrowed my focus to I only approve of non-edible renewable energy, meaning that soybean oil, field corn, sugarcane should not be converted into motor fuels while humans are starving. My question that I wanted to ask is about the ideal growing temperatures for those bacteria. What range of temperatures can they stand, and could they survive 33 degrees through the winter and grow again in the spring? I'm thinking of Louisiana fish farms or Arkansas rice paddies or Wisconsin cranberry bogs. Is it possible to dual crop this bacteria? Do they float on the surface or do they sink to the bottom in a pond?
So these are typically aquatic bacteria that we isolate from nature. We are not thinking about growing them as in ponds like you would grow algae or cyanobacteria, where we're looking at growing them in more of an industrial environment. I will say that none of the crops that we are processing on campus in Great Lakes Bioenergy are food grade crops. We are not working on corn. We are not working on soybean. We are not working on any crops that would produce material that provide animals or people food. We are only working on so-called dedicated bioenergy crops, things like rapidly growing trees, poplar, switchgrass, and other crops that we're specifically breeding to produce fuel molecules and chemicals like these furan fatty acids.
Very, very good. Thank you very much, Ron, for that question. Scott in New Berlin, it's your turn. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Hey, I'd like to echo the thoughts of the previous caller. It's like turning corn and soybeans into fuel is stupid, and ethanol is a lousy fuel for a gasoline engine. So that's my first thought was let's try to replace the ethanol, not enhance it like you were talking earlier. The best thing we could do is get off ethanol. And I've heard that a lot of governments are trying to ban the internal combustion engine in the future and whatnot. Hopefully this will – I have nothing against electric cars. They have their purpose, but I can't get in here and drive to Denver in my electric car. So the gasoline engine is still going to need to be around for a while, and hopefully this will improve its life and efficiency and get more renewables going in different directions and all that. So it's more of a comment than a question. So
yeah.
Keep up the good work and try to replace ethanol.
Tim, do you want to comment on that?
Well, I try to stay out of the politics of ethanol versus other fuels and deal with the science, but I will just come back to what I said before, and that is this is a molecule that we are developing to replace as a renewable source of the hydrocarbons that we currently get from fossil fuels. If we get to a place where the automotive fleet is not based on gasoline, but is based on electrics and hybrids, is a very important conversation. But I agree with the caller, it's going to take us a long time to get there. And we would like to have fuels that burn in my gasoline-driven car that come from renewable sources as quickly as we can. Someday I might actually get on a plane and go somewhere again, and I would like to have jet engines that are burning renewable hydrocarbons like this one, as well as I would like to see long-haul shipping and naval shipping being driven by as much of renewable hydrocarbons as possible. That's the vision of what we're trying to create.
Yeah. Scott, thank you so much. Farmer in Elkhorn, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I tell you, I'm excited to hear that somebody's been able to raise the burn temperatures, get a more complete burn with it. You know, but my thing is, right now, they put out diesel trucks with an additive called DEF to make it cleaner. And they've got expensive catalytic converters on them. And when you check them against a motor, very similar, 10, 15 years older, the older one runs cleaner than the new one. But we keep adding all this stuff. And I'm just wondering how this fuel is going to affect the whole transportation industry, because, you know, we've got people that can take a four-cylinder engine, put it in the car, and hurl it around the track at 200 miles an hour. But we can't seem to get more than freaking 15 miles per gallon out of a vehicle, you know, 25 at the top. How is this fuel going to – how do you see this affecting transportation? Do you see them actually – thinking again and using stuff that is cleaner? I mean, with what you're talking about, I mean, I didn't hear how hotter your stuff burns, but you know, any braising it at all and putting an oxygenator in there, that's brilliant. So, but I just, you know, I just see it and I go, you know what, this is great, but you know, why can't we have cars that get 50, 60 miles to the gallon on gasoline? I had a Volkswagen Jetta 2000 with a four-cylinder diesel with a turbo and a five-speed. It got 52 miles to the gallon. On 12.5 gallons of gas, I ran 765 miles. Now, why can't we do that with cars? And so my question is, how do you see the fuel affecting the transportation industry? And do you see them actually, I mean, because this, you're saying this fuel is cleaner, and I'm sure it is. So do we still need catalytic converters? Do we still need, you know, somebody pumping oxygen into an exhaust system so it may, appears to be cleaner? They did, you know, GM and Ford and all of them had done that for a while. I'm sorry I'm running on, but.
Well, let's see what our guests have to say. Tim, do you want to take a crack at that?
Sure, I'll take a crack at that and say that you're asking all the right questions, and I would say two things. I would say we have not made enough of this to put into an engine yet. So everything I've tried to say and Rochelle has tried to say is that it has the potential to do all of these things. In terms of the combustion issues, Larry, I might defer that and say I'm a microbiologist. I know how engines work in principle, but I don't live in the engine world. If you haven't done it recently, Larry, it might be really a cool idea to have someone from the Engine Institute on to talk about what they're doing over in the College of Engineering, which has one of the best engine centers in the world, to think about the combustion issues that your caller is talking about. They might be able to address what's different about fuels in a NASCAR, and I think it's mostly ethanol, and they're very light. They're lighter than the SUVs and cars that most of us tend to be buying these days. And so all of those things affect miles per gallon.
Yeah, they do indeed. Thank you so much for calling. I really appreciate your call. You know, as I've been thinking about this, pondering this, Tim, you and I have been talking about, I think for 13 years, about the word. I think it was 2007, wasn't it?
It was 2007 when Great Lakes Bioenergy was first funded. We're in the midst of our third five-year funding cycle, and we're actually planning what we might do with the next 5 years of funding out to year 20.
Yeah, you know, maybe just it'd be fun to talk about some of the accomplishments from the center over the last 13 years, because things certainly haven't stood still, as we've been hearing about today, certainly with your work and Rochelle's work.
No, they haven't. And Larry, thanks for asking me, if you will, to beat our own chest a little bit. As a university center, UW-Madison, in partnership mostly with our sister campus over in East Lansing at Michigan State, we've done a lot of things that I never envisioned we'd be able to do. We've published a lot of papers, which is what academics do, over almost 1,400 now. But we filed almost 250 patent applications with the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation and their partner over at MSU, the MSU Technologies Office. To connect to a point that a previous caller made, those have led to over 100 licenses and options. So industry is taking these advances on. And as universities, we're particularly proud of the fact that we've trained over 1,000 young scientists who have gone out to work in industry, work in technology transfer, form startup companies, as well as take university jobs like mine. Something else that we're really very excited about is to capture the potential that many of the callers have correctly asked about. How do you take these advances and discoveries that we make at a university like Wisconsin and test them at scale? Maybe you'll have me on in a future call, but we're really excited about this future bioeconomy, and the university is in the midst of actually working with over 100 companies to try and bring a biomanufacturing institute initiative to life to really take the discoveries that we make in an academic lab and bring them out to industries in the Midwest and around the country for all of these uses. To me, that's another phase of where we need to go.
Well, I tell you what, this is pretty exciting stuff, Rachelle. I think you've got a few years of work left for this, though.
Yeah, there's always more work to be done. It's job security.
Oh, well, I tell you what, I want to thank you both very much for taking the time to be with us today. And you know that, I like the Engine Institute. We should get a show going on that, because certainly there's interest in that. And also this Biomanufacturing Institute idea. We need to explore that a little bit more, Tim.
Let's see what the future holds, and we can work with your team, Larry, to give you ideas of names for people from the Engine Institute to have on a future show. Because, as always, we want the people of the state to know what's going on at the university. It's all part of the Wisconsin. It's all part of energizing the Wisconsin idea, I call it.
Tim, Rachelle, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it, and we'll have you back and do this again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Larry. Hopefully next time it'll be in person.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping for, too. Tim Donahue directs the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, and he's also interim director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Trying to think back when he was first named interim. He's been interim a long time, it feels like to me, but he's doing a great job, as is Rachelle Lemke, a senior research specialist, one of those 1,000 or so students that Tim was talking about that kind of grew up in the labs at the UW-Madison. Great to have both of them with us, and we will talk about energy again on the program. That is for sure. Coming up, we're going to switch gears a bit and talk with you about the weather and about things like heat indexes with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. That coming up next. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.